The following broadcast was produced by the Lighthouse for the Blind in San Francisco as part of our Lighthouse Learning Library.
Brian, did you try the gloves at the convention?
I have, yeah. And I think it is really important to explore those avenues to see how much we can process and how much we can parallel process, how much we can overcome what some people say is the serial nature of information for the blind, and how much we can do in multiple channels that allow us to do that.
If you study that, you're all right.
But I want to explore another avenue with you. I'm a little conscious of my time, so let me just ask this one. Take as long as you like to answer it, though.
Can I watch you fidget while I do that?
If I say the number 70%, what does that conjure up?
Well, you know, that's the thing. This Lowenfeld paper showed something like 36% unemployment or something.
That's right, and we have other numbers. If the unemployment rate is 54%, it's a little better maybe than 70%. But here's the thing. Your father was born in 1910, 100 years ago. He worked pretty much continuously. You've worked pretty much continuously. Here's a generation of, two generations of blind people working and making a lot of money. You own a house in San Francisco. It's not too bad. But why has that rate been so persistent in our community?
The 70%
figure? The 70%, and what can we do to
change it? Because
it
came in handy, for one thing. But you know, it may be that bad. I have no idea. Also, don't forget that employment meant something different then. I mean, people didn't, we didn't have expectations like we should have had. Should we have, if we had had those, if we had wanted to be professionals, if we had wanted something other than Rosie the Riveter was working, maybe it would be 70, 80%. Who knows what this figure means? I've never known other than it was mentioned. Where does it come from? It sure came in handy, though.
But beyond the actual figure, the fact of persistent, massive unemployment, how is it that your family didn't have those huge periods, and how do we change the situation for our community?
I would love to ask you a question at the end of my answer, but here's something that I've decided. Privilege almost always works. What do I mean, privilege? Well, money sometimes works. Money almost always, like any privilege, works. Money might do it, but certainly wasn't true in my ancestry. They were homesteaders and that kind of stuff, but they knew how to do things. Everything in my family had to do with a craft or a trade. Everybody was involved in a trade. All the sighted folks, of course. And piano tuning was something that was chosen because, well, Bill, you should have a trade. It wasn't because, do you know, I think blind people have bigger ears, and so they should be piano tuners. What a dumb job for a blind person. Now, I say that knowing that they put me through school on it, but you know, you got to get to the piano. I've given talks on this, on unlikely occupations. How come vending stands work so well for us, even though we can't recognize the money? I mean, part of it, there's a book by Deborah Kendrick. It's called Business Owners Who Are Blind. And it's full of people who have, there's a blind flower arranger, for God's sakes. Does she arrange the flowers? No. She hires the people who do arrange the flowers. She runs the business. Most of the jobs that we don't have are things that you know, are way out of reach. I can't drive a taxi, so I won't drive a taxi. But that doesn't mean that I couldn't run the taxi company. On the other hand, how do you get that far? How do you get to be the one who runs the flower arranging business? How do you get to be the one who is the transportation coordinator for a trucking company? It comes from privilege. And by privilege, I mean all kinds of stuff. Did your mom and your sister read to you when you were a kid? Do you know enough about history so that describing the trade routes that would explain the peninsula of Italy and its importance, did that come from anything but privilege? He may say that he grew up on in a rural community, but somewhere along the line he had that privilege.
Well, he had the privilege of having a great and inquiring mind. I mean, that's the privilege he had.
That by itself doesn't cut it. There are a lot of people with great minds who don't know what to inquire. They need the privilege to find out enough to get them going. Mm-hmm. You need to prime the pump. I'm a nurture versus nature guy. I'm sure it takes both, but the nature part is secondary. You need to prime the pump, and you prime it with privilege of various sorts. We got a young man running the board over here. There was nothing gonna stop him, nothing. He had terrible luck as a child in how he became blind, and yet there is a very, very successful young man. He got there partly because when I was teaching this little class of blind kids at the Lawton School, I was teaching them a course I made up called Principles of Electricity and Magnetism. And we were making things on pieces of wood and stuff like that, and with screws. And I handed them screwdrivers and tools and things like that, which they got to keep after the class. All of them said the best part of the class was to get the tools and to have somebody show them how to use them. His father walked in and said, "You're having my son use this mechanical screwdriver." So he walked in and he gave Shen here an electric screwdriver. That's privilege. And it's not replaceable as far as I can tell.
And what's the question you're going to ask Brian?
What was your childhood? How come you're so damn smart? I don't care about after you were blind or as you were going blind. What was your background as a child?
Well, it was some of what you were talking about. I mean, I didn't have chemistry sets and formal things, but my father worked in the aviation and then space business, and the things that he brought home were wires and motors and transformers and meters, and what I just played with stuff, made it burn, made it break, made it smoke, built stuff, and the idea of any child to manipulate nature instead of being passive. That's why I'm so interested in the richness of the old days when you could make a vacuum tube do something or something where you could feel it in your hand and understand it. Blind kids, if you listen to Gary Vermeer, he's so disappointed by how blind kids do not inquire with their fingers, inspect, deeply view things. And that kind of thing, that issue of passivity versus activity, I think is at the real core of some of the employment problems. You can point to, you know, you need eyesight for certain things. You can point to discrimination. Yes, I'm not going to say that doesn't exist in the world. But more profound than that is the idea of whose life is this anyway? Whose disability, whose job is it to manage one's disability? Is it the is it the school districts to take me from class to class? Is it the transcribers to write down my notes? Is it the disabled students program at university? You know, is it Section 8 and paratransit and the whole litany? Yeah. Or do I have to somehow figure out to suck it up in this world? And if you acquire that sense that the locus of responsibility is with you, then the rest are just details. And if you don't, nothing will help.
One thing that can happen is to interrupt a person's search for experience. For example, if you tell a blind child, don't be opening drawers all the time and looking at the people. This is a very, you'll never get anywhere if you keep feeling everything. Mm-hmm. And you can tell the difference for sure between a person who is born blind and has had a supportive, let him open the drawers and play with the flatware and the egg beater and stuff. From a person who's been discouraged, because the person who's been discouraged also probably doesn't have good stability when he stands up. Mm-hmm. Don't fall. Don't stand up, you'll fall. Okay? There's the other population of people who have become blind late. And I've noticed that there is a generous percentage this way or that. If I in my lab show a blind person who was blinded way early and just is used to exploring things, if I show them something, if I hand them this tuning fork, he will have his hands all over this thing, and then we can strike it and make it. Sorry, next door. And the table isn't a very good sounding board, but anyway, he might try things. If I show it to somebody who's just gone blind, or an older person who's gone blind, he will hold it until I finish talking, and then he'll hand it back.
Hmm.
It's a very discouraging difference. Hmm. Now, the guy who holds it and gonna hand it back might have been an airline mechanic or pilot or pianist. Doesn't matter. He's not getting it. He didn't have the privilege of actually exploring something with his fingers, nor does the kid who's been discouraged. So there are ways to inhibit somebody's experience and inhibit their privilege, to take it away from them, which is exactly what you said. Whose disability is it anyway? Am I to manage his? Is his mom supposed to manage his? You know.
But I would just, speaking as a sighted person who is, as they say, temporarily able, visually dependent, I do think that who's obviously we all need, whatever our conditions of our body, we all need to have an internal locus of control. That we need to manage things. But on the other hand, and this goes back to what we were talking about on the bus ride, Bill, there is a social responsibility. There is, and I'm coming to the opinion, that there is a cost to blindness. And certain amounts of that cost are paid by the blind person himself when he buys a screen reading program for his computer that he really needs in order to deal with his computer that the sighted person doesn't need to buy. But there are certain costs that are borne by society at large, and I think that's fine, like paying for someone to go to an NFB training center. And I suspect, Brian, that you were someone with an internal locus of control even before you went to the NFB training center. That might have enabled you to apply it more. But I think what you got out of there were skills that were necessary for you to be an independent that added to your ability to be an independent productive person. So I don't know how much. I don't know how much the unemployment question. I mean, it's both. It's people being lacking the confidence. On the other hand, that notion of the social basis for disability. Disability is imposed on people who have an impairment. That's as some disability people talk. That disability is in expecting less of them and preventing them from developing themselves. Mm-hmm. So there's both sides of it. There's a wonderful guy, a sighted man, who's an active participant in the state Parents of Blind Children group, who has been involved with it since his blind daughter was very little. And she's grown up around the NFB, and she's a timid person. I believe in nurture rather than nature, but some people don't develop in that way. Despite the fact that, as far as I can see, her father was, just did everything right. So. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's. I guess you can never guarantee hope. Having a blind child, by the way, there's a woman who wrote a book about they don't come with, this is about her sighted son, they don't come with instructions. Man, talk about not coming with instructions. What, you mean I've got five senses and little Nudnik here has four? Mm. Oh, man. And so my heart goes out to them. One argument for the residential school, which I found it, I don't know how long I could have lasted. So far be it for me to argue for them, except that they got a temporary parentectomy, and it seems to have helped.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that Kenneth Jernigan might not have needed a parentectomy, but the privilege that you were talking about might have come from him being at the Tennessee school, where he learned how to read and became a voracious reader. That might be the source of his Mark Maurer had the great fortune of his mother teaching him Braille, making a point of learning to do it.
Yeah.
Do you think you had a distinct advantage because your father was blind? And
oh, I think there were advantages, sure.
Tell me about those.
Well, I mean, just the fact that I knew so many. I mean, now I guess I can count. I knew seven generations of blind people, from very, very old codgers when I was a baby, little, to the youngsters of today. That's nice to have had.
What does that teach you, both intellectually and also just emotionally?
Well, emotionally is that they provided at least an experience base, a social experience. A population that was extensive enough that I know that there is a discrimination, by the way, an active one that was at least practiced against people with retinopathy of prematurity versus people with blastoma. They think blastoma people are smart, and they think the others are disadvantaged, and that's why their mobility is so bad. Nonsense.
I never heard that before.
The guy who works for me is one of the premature babies, and he has 80 flying hours in the in an airplane under his experience. It's nonsense. I mean, I use my single point against their single point. Mine's correct and theirs isn't. That doesn't matter. But just the number of people I've known who had no disadvantage as far as physiology that I know of, who are the types, and some people who were severely disabled, like this fellow with rheumatoid arthritis, who was a very well-rounded person and who told me as a small boy why balls bounce. So, you know, I've been around enough of them to know that there is something to what the Federation always held, and that is we are a normal cross-section of society. Our experience may put us at a disadvantage. Discrimination may put us at a disadvantage. But man, oh man, we're still just as much a variety. And so in that sense, I think it did me well to be. And also, you know, my sighted mother taught me how to get along with other people. She badgered me more than my father. Oh, you know, here's an interesting thing that went on in blind schools. Radio was a big deal. And then when my father was there, by 1922, they all were messing with radio circuits and so forth. So it's so much so that they were, as just because one of them made the phone call, they showed up at KRE radio as a whistling troupe and whistled, "Please don't talk about me while till I'm gone."
When I'm gone.
And you know, those things were all over the place, and they hooked their bed springs together as the antenna and all kinds of stuff. And then the schools, certainly after World War II, adopted ham radio as a shop class, and they built some parts of it and so forth. And my mother made sure that I got a ham radio license when I was 13. Why? Because she knew that that would get me in touch with a good class of people, a class of people who had to study, who took a test, old codgers, some. My high school buddies, others, and as a social rehabilitation tool, it was tops because I got rides to places. It was just wonderful.
Huh. Yeah.
So that hobby never let me down.
Well, this is a great time for me to pause. I've got to earn a living a little bit right now. But I'm going to encourage you to just continue for a long time.
This isn't living.
Right. This isn't earning.
This is living. It's not earning.
It's not earning.
I took off my headphones. And I realized you were over there. I was listening to you the other way.
Yeah. Isn't that neat?
Yeah.
Optical or auditory illusions are good.
Let me just say, you've got this as long as you want it. But when you're done, come and see me. I'll be in my office just down the hall.
Okay. Well, he can't want more of this, can he?
Well, yeah, I kind of feel like we're winding up, but let's give it a few more minutes. Yeah.
Brian,
yes.
You're a prince of a fellow.
Oh, this is so
I'd
much
stand
fun.
Stand up, but I'm very old.
No, you enjoy. Okay. And we'll talk when you finish.
Okay, right. Great, sure.
Thank you again.
Okay.
This is just
well, thank you for making this available to us.
Oh, let's hope there's many more to come.
Okay, terrific.
Okay, enjoy, guys.
I just would like to get into a few other things that you and I talked about both on the phone and earlier today. It's so artificial to be doing it this way. It was so much easier before. But you talked about the success of the NFB of placing people in of getting blind people in agencies. And the unintended consequence of that.
Be careful what you wish for. You might get it.
Uh-huh. And this is your perception, because you were around at the time of
this
split.
Yeah, I was young, but I think I've assembled it properly. The fact is that blind folks were very minimally involved in our own services intended for us and so forth, and rehabilitation where it existed and like that. But Jacobus ten Broek, and through some of the very bright people that he had associated with him, was quite a brain trust, really. And it existed in California until Dr. ten Broek died, and then it was automatically, of course, divided between California and Iowa. But anyhow, so we, as the Federation, tried, because my involvement was so small, they got people placed in the agencies. There were people working for us. We had people working for us. And they were in the agencies that were sometimes private. Sometimes they were part of the federal rehabilitation system as it progressed in its development. And the problem then was, how does the Federation make a decision that might call upon those who were in those positions to speak out? And it became impossible for some to speak out. Wait a minute, this is the first job I've had and I'm doing fine and I'm And they panicked. The Federation, of course, Jacobus ten Broek was driven, if anything, and has always considered itself as a union and operates like a union, wanted essentially, no, this time you've got to go out and campaign with us on a thing that's going to be in complete contradiction to where you work. Or, you've got to lie down in front of that bus there. Not quite that, but figuratively so.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, there had to come a split. There just couldn't. There was no way to run this fledgling group of people who had finally gotten somewhere and just say, you'll have to put that aside, look at where we've gotten you. That just won't work. So there was that tension that led to the split between the organizations. For all the time that I was involved, Tim Cranmer was right. You go to the ACB and a well-meaning social worker will walk up to you and say, "Hi, Bill. Oh, it's great to see you, isn't it? Isn't it great to see you? How have you been? What are you up to? Are you still working?"
Bill is patting himself.
Patting myself. And at the Federation, it's, hey, Bill, how goes the struggle? And that's quite a difference. And there was no way those two were ever going to meet philosophically. So
okay. Well,
I don't blame the split. It's just it was horrifying to watch.
Huh. Okay. Well, that kind of presents a view of the mechanism underneath what the way the NFB explains it. For the NFB, it's just frequently from the NFB, it's just that the ACB people just for some reason want to accede to the agencies. I mean, you provide a better understanding of that, but it still conforms to the overall NFB view of it, which is interesting to hear from you. I think I told you earlier that I'm reading the ACB history, and I'm trying to develop a sense of how of how they view it, and certainly from the very start, talking about this woman from North Carolina, was it Marie Boring, Mary Boring, who was brought North Carolina into the NFB. And became an agency person there. She ended up being very much in the leadership of the split group, and she did have an agency position. So that's that conforms to that. That's,
now, if you talk to most of them, they'll say, "Well, we don't want to be part of a union that doesn't take opinions into account.
Mm-hmm.
That you can't have an opinion in the NFB."
Well, what
but
do you
here you can have an opinion because we're democratic.
Well, what do you think of that?
Well, I mean, that's a circumloquacious way to go about the philosophical problem that you would have. What if Jackie Presser held a bunch of elections all the time, and the mine workers or the Teamsters or the so-and-so, you know, really in a time when people are walking around saying, I don't want no third party representing me, about their union.
Yeah.
Well, the hell with those guys, you know. I mean, let them work for a non-union foreign operated car assembly plant. Maybe it's okay for them. But maybe there's some stuff that needs to go on.
So you really see the NFP as analogous to a union.
Yeah.
And you think that's I mean, my sense was that particularly in the 50s during the right to organize struggle with the Kennedy-Baring bill, that Tenbrook was really taking his lead from the struggles in the 1930s to organize labor. That was much.
Boy, I don't know. I wouldn't be able to speak to that philosophy without Hazel Tenbrook at my elbow. But I hope that's true.
Uh-huh. Did Hazel talk with you about
only we had neat discussions. That time I argued with her about our tax credit, why we would be willing to give it up. Because you talked about the cost of blindness,
yeah,
and, you know, and I had I took the opposite side a couple of years earlier with my father. He said, "Okay, let me show you the AFB catalog. You tell me that this isn't more expensive."
Mm-hmm.
So you know, she said, "Well, we have to make certain compromises, and this is just one of them, as to surrender our tax." Our extra tax deduction. And I said, are you kidding? Look at the, and you ought to look in the AFP catalog. But Hazel was very patient with me. We didn't resolve the issue. And God, I love that woman. Oh, my.
And you got to know her better after Tenbrook died? Or?
Yeah, I got to know her more and more. I saw her a lot.
Huh.
Yeah.
Just because you were fond of her,
yes, you weren't. I'd call her up.
You weren't an active member of the NFB, but you were personally close to her.
I kept up my membership, but
you paid your $5 a year,
yeah,
or whatever.
Yeah. Or whenever I went to a convention, I'd join three or four things. I'd join the student division and the technical, something technical, and I'd walk in, even if the vendors were having something interesting, I'd give my $5 to that treasurer too. I'd pass out $5 bills like crazy. Mm.
What was else I'm going to ask you? Were you the only blind student at Poly when you were there, at Cal Poly?
For a while, yes. Then there was a guy who came there who heard about me, and he ended up being institutionalized. He, on the other hand, had never had any fair handling as a child. Of showing him things. He ate his mashed potatoes with his hands.
Oh.
He didn't know how to do it. And yet they really bent over backwards for him. That me, I was on trial by fire for about a year and a half.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I suppose it doesn't help to show up with your mother to everything. But she could drive, huh? So anyway, we walk into the Dean of Engineering's office and I ask if we could have a list of the textbooks so that I could have them recorded and so forth and advanced. And he said, wait a minute, what sent you here? I said, well, a lot of my friends, have come to Cal Poly, and I'd like to go here. It's got a good reputation, and I don't know. There was some weakness in him though that says, okay, we'll let you go here for 6 months, which was equivalent to 2 quarters.
Mm-hmm.
It was 3 quarters per year, and he said, we'll see how you do. Well, I did okay, and so they and by the time I was into my sophomore year, there were teachers who wondered what they were doing wrong. He's an A student everywhere else, and every one of those teachers was wondering that, because I wasn't an A student anywhere. but they accepted me to that extent.
And campus life in general with the other students, were you isolated or did you?
No, I was in the dorm and I had a ball.
Yeah. Oh, great. Well, I guess we're running out of steam. I wish I could. Maybe I'll make another trip to San Francisco.
You can always do it on the phone.
Yeah.
I promise you a good quality phone line.
Yeah.
Do you hear that, Shen? You can be replaced by a lousy landline.
No, I'm sure this is particularly good situation. So why do you think you haven't been? I mean, you seem to have to very strongly hold to the NFB philosophy, yet it seems that it hasn't been that important to you to participate. Do you ever go to local chapter meetings?
On occasion, I've been known to stick my nose in there.
Uh-huh.
And I've been known to stick my nose into ACB.
Really?
And I never could manage that divided loyalty. I mean, that dumping one set of friends. We were friends with both of them.
Uh-huh. Well, I think I told you on the phone that there are some ACBers that I've had alluded to as being fine people, even by bureaucrats in the NFB's national office. So I'm sure, by the way,
the reason that you can't be a member of NFB and be in the ACB is because, again, the union. If you go around saying, "Well, I'm a member of NFB and I don't think that way," that's not cutting it.
Mm-hmm.
In their view, nor is it cutting it. I mean, if you want to be in a union, be in the union. The ACB doesn't care. You can be a member of NFB in there.
Yeah.
I've transgressed most of my life. in that regard, because I've kept dual memberships.
Huh.
But I'm an outlier.
Yeah.
So.
The preceding material is owned and distributed by the Lighthouse for the Blind in San Francisco, California. To obtain permission to use this content for classes or other uses, please contact us at publications@lighthouse-sf.org. Or to learn more about the Lighthouse, visit our website at www.lighthouse-sf.org.